First, the atomic stage, the embryonic condition, and then the earthly life of man. All life is unfolded in darkness because darkness is negative, and light is positive. These two forces are essential in all forms of life, therefore, it requires the same element to produce any spiritual manifestation. Man came upon your earth plane without his volition, and will go away the same route, and passing out of the material form is inevitable, and although a natural law, there are thousands of men and women who never think of passing out, they think only of material things, not knowing how soon they may cross to the great beyond, where life is everlasting, and eternal. You are the children of the same mother, and the same journey awaits you all. Another life is sure, and you will know and love again the ones who loved you here. The all-wise and infinite intelligence has placed upon you, your earth nature in all her perfection for you to improve and utilize, and cause the great wheel of progress to revolve. Without this intelligence, what could man hope to accomplish? Many developments of the past ages go to show that a very thin veil separates the known from the unknown. And what are called occult or spirit powers, are nothing but natural powers not yet revealed by the efforts of science, or are manifested so definitely that they can be apprehended as natural facts. Wireless telegraphy is an accepted scientific fact, because its power of manifestation has been shown to be within the sphere of nature's laws. And your scientific men are working to dispel the cloud of ignorance which prevents you from understanding. Every fact which can be brought within the cognizance of the senses, is a natural fact. There is no such thing as supernatural, in fact there is nothing supernatural. All things are natural, even your organs of apprehension are not yet attuned to it and they may never be. It would almost seem as if science herself were about to demonstrate the existence of a higher sphere of vibration by strictly inductive methods. These reigned states of matter bring you consciously nearer the limits of what you may conceive of the spiritual. Science will yet prove the fact of a future life for man. Man is conceded to be the highest and the most intelligent of organized beings, and if he were asked the extent of the universe, he would reply that it was bounded by the visible horizon. The vast sweep of land and sea encircling your stupendous globe. The innumerable host of suns and planets, comets and nebulae are to him unknown. To him they do not exist, and any attempt to prove their existence would be futile, because he cannot conceive of them since they are entirely beyond the grasp of his senses. So with the materialist, a spiritual universe does not exist for him, simply because he cannot examine it with any of his five senses. The vast majority of persons are not critical readers, and it is for that reason they will be pleased with this book. Man in his primitive state was held so close under the thrall of superstition that he attributed the moving of the leaves, the flowing of streams, the falling of rain, and other phenomena of nature to invisible spirits, and whatever might be the harm or benefit therefrom, he would distinguish likewise to be visited upon him with good or evil. Scientific spiritualism has shown the superphysical cause of many, or all of these phenomena, while science seeks for the physical cause of things rather than be content with the primitive assumption or superphysical. But the human mind has a tendency to ascribe almost anything to the superphysical, that it cannot understand. It is well known that science has not yet discovered the nature of life nor its origin. For this reason there always have been and still are many persons who hold that in addition to the chemical components of all living beings, there is a mysterious force. They object that natural forces are just as capable as any other mechanical principle to explain life. To this the opponents answer, "It does not follow that you never will find a satisfactory physical explanation of life. It is and has been a query as to a future existence ever since the creation of the world. All of the great religions have taught it, but have never been able to prove it. The most savage races of people are visited by spirits. Is it not strange that those noble souls, so full of hope and interest in earth life and in human affairs, should pass away and never be heard of again, and those hearts, bound to you by an affection so strong, should love you and never come to you anymore? This is not the case, my friends. They do come to you whether you are aware of it or not. There has always been a vague belief in spirits, apparitions of the dead, and spiritual manifestations. Another great difficulty as to your continued existence, is the dissolution of the body. All that you know of human life is in connection with the body. You believe that man existed, then why not believe that spirits existed? Without man's physical existence, there would be no spiritual existence. Bear that in mind, my friends. Can you make something out of nothing? We do not refuse to the animal all hope of continued existence. The living principle in the animal is capable of development into a higher mode of existence after the death of the body. All life has a counterpart, spirit, for all creation of life is from one great source of intelligence. Man's soul is developed by knowledge. As his body grows old and decays, his mind continues to advance. So careful is nature that she never uses one atom of matter, one molecule of organized matter or one unit of power without its effect and results. If you would ask the skeptic what do you know about another life, he must reply that he knew very little about it. And if he did, it might take his thoughts too far away from his earthly duties. He thinks if he was able to look into the great beyond, he might regret being obliged to remain in this life so long. So he makes it his duty to think, not of the hereafter, but of the world that is now. The all-wise and infinite power sends death to every one of his creatures to whom he has given life, since death is as universal as life. Death must be a blessing as well as life. It is a part of the great change, it is a step forward only to another phase of living. There are a great many advantages connected with the event which you call death. Consider what the great infinite intelligence has done for you in your earthly abode, and then what it will do for you in spirit life. There is infinite variety in the spirit world. There are flowers and trees, lakes and rivers. There is a greater variety over here, for surely the wise intelligence has not exhausted itself in making our world. There is beyond, for the eye and ear, problems for the intellect to investigate, work to do, usefulness in social intercourse and affection, the power of progression, the signs of goodness and greatness and the hope to aspire. Here you will enter more into the interior life of nature, and can come nearer to the work of the creative power. Nature not only wisely and kindly provides the supply to satisfy all proper desires, but it has created within you a longing, an instinct that is well nigh infallible, in leading you to the source of this supply. We might illustrate this by the migratory instincts of birds. They instinctively yearn for the south, and implicitly following that instinct, it directs them to the south. It is also noticeable again, that in the instinct of direction, with which animals are endowed, and following the impulse of that instinct, it leads them to the desired point, in their journeying. When animals are sick they have an instinct that there is a remedy, and following that instinct, they find the desired remedy. So in the physical department of your being, you hunger for food, and following that longing of hunger, you are speedily directed to a supply of that which you most need. In the mental department of your being, you may have constant cravings for knowledge, and the longing of the mind carries it to the fountain of learning. If you reason by analogy, would it not seem exceedingly reasonable that desire would be as reliable in the higher realms of your being as in those lower departments? If you are safely guided by desire in the physical, the social, and the intellectual departments of your being, you would be fully as safely guided by the higher desires of the soul. All of life's earthly avenues have been trodden in vain, and man has returned to the point of beginning, as thoroughly unsatisfied as when he entered them. When I speak of being abundantly satisfied, when your spiritual desires lead you to the great infinite spirit, I do not mean to imply that this satisfaction, or sensuous fervor is delicious ecstasy, or soft, dreamy rapture. Being satisfied with spiritual truth, you do not retire from domestic life, nor from congenial society, nor from business activities, nor from educational enterprises, nor from philanthropic efforts, nor from reform movements. You take spiritual knowledge into your heart, and being satisfied in it and with it, you are better fitted to enter all of these spheres just mentioned, and all the other avenues of life that are honorable and pure, than you were before, and all the callings of secular life are hallowed and made sacred by taking spiritual knowledge into your soul. But having found complete satisfaction in spiritual knowledge, you have been saved from that sickly, morbid craving for sinful pleasures and worldly amusements, that had so constantly controlled you hitherto. What the soul has been seeking hither and thither has found, at last, in spiritual truth, and seeks no farther in other directions. It is true that not all professed spiritualists possess this sense of satisfaction that the spirits promise and that the spiritualists may enjoy, and that some spiritualists frequently, indeed almost constantly, may be found on the level of the world, seeking pleasure where worldlings seek it. Your world has been abused by the intense cultivation of a narrow and ignorant religious spirit concerning a future life. Nothing should be more glorifying to the average race than the hope of another life. As the spirit world overarches the earth, so the great life of the hereafter overhangs and perfects the feeling of a vanishing existence. To all wise and intelligent minds, force meant something when it created your world, and established its manifold economies. It was not made on a chance. The experiences of your world are all valuable and necessary. Your environment on earth is absolutely necessary to your education and culture. Our chief business, just now, is with the material world. We know its laws and their influence over you and human civilization. The world you live in was evidently framed to bring to you happiness. Beautiful light for the eyes, sweet sounds for the ear, pure air for the lungs, scenes of glorious beauty for the soul, facts for the perceptive faculty, truth for the conscience, law for the reason. You abuse your world when you deny the right to be happy in it. Your world is the stepping stone to the next. It suggests and necessitates a higher and better world. There is no love on your earth in child, or maiden or mother, or martyr, that does not point to the immortal love that shall outweary mortal sin. All things in nature are real, and human life confirms the testimony that you complete beyond what you begin on earth. Your world is a schoolhouse, and men and women are the pupils. For what purpose do you learn your lessons and slowly acquire your culture, if there be no other, no progressive life? There is such a life, it is yours if you but strive for it. You win it by faithful, honest, loving action in the life that now is. While the world lasts, spiritualism must be preached and will succeed only as the same rules are steadily followed. We want earliest living men and women, who will stoop down to suffering humanity, and manifest the spirit of the Good Samaritan, stop with a word of comfort, a look of love, a helping hand. Note the vastness of a sea, the grandeur of a towering mountain, the measureless concave of the midnight sky blazing with constellations. Each of these soothes and settles the agitated mind, and fills the soul with sublime musings of him who notes the fall of a sparrow, as well as superintends the destiny of worlds. It is and has been a familiar utterance, that your world is full of sin. My friends, you should not forget that sin is not so much in the world as it is in the people. The more you study the work of nature, the more intense and intelligent will be your love for it. Do not the spirits direct the attention of its hearers to the world of nature around you? It must be seen, however, to the most casual observer, that the wisdom of nature is displayed in the adaptation of means to ends. In all animal, vegetable and plant life, from the simplest to the most complex, there is a plan for each, a condition and a means. Human life is not plundering the world, but for improving it. The philosophy of soul mating, Countess Lolita. There never was nor yet ever will be a complete feminine soul without the masculine counterpart. Nor vice versa. The feminine represents tenderness, pity, shyness, truth and love, while the masculine is truly composed of boldness, undaunted courage, strength, firmness and stubbornness of purpose, and the very fact of all these very fine elements so mingling and interblending as to make a complete whole, introduces to you the philosophy of soul mating. Therefore no soul stands alone as a whole, for somewhere in the finitude is the other half, the twin soul, the counterpart of each other, and these two in one must each be so constituted as to possess qualifications that exactly fit each other, and when that great immutable law can do its work without a single line of cross-vibration, then these two half-souls find each other, and form a whole soul. It is so preposterous for a man or a woman to boast of his or her particular achievements, saying, "I am perfectly independent of the other sex, for my accomplishments in life. I only depend upon myself for my wonderful results." so the results of labor may be truly good, for where there is great labor there is also excellence. But again we must tell you that a thing however complete it may in the mortal conception, if it be performed wholly by a male or female, then it is to our understanding only half of what it would have been if a whole soul had worked it out into completion. You will naturally ask, if there is such a law as the law of soul mating, why does nature allow so many to unite upon earth who are not truly mated, and hence, all the trouble and sorrow that now exists be left to continuously happen at will? We answer, in the great laboratory of nature are a special workman, who only perform her wonders and mysteries upon certain existing laws that she possesses. But before any law of nature can be enacted upon, there must certain conditions arising that are perfectly and properly conducive to the consummation of such ends, and until these conditions are ripened and ready there can be no complete action of these truly wonderful laws. There is no undertaking of spirit or mortal, but what rests on a certain vibration of conditions to perform its accomplishment. Now within the laws of attraction and repulsion there are live and existing certain forces that attract, and certain ones that repel. A wave vibration coming between these two forces would partake of each one only to the extent of conditions at the time. If the law of repulsion caught up the tiny wave, then the object of the humanity to which this tiny wave must eventually travel would be repulsed entirely from the object of his soul, or the mate of his soul, while if the wave was caught effectually by the law of attraction and traveled to both souls of like nature, then the consummation could only result in a meeting of these soul mates. The law of repulsion oftentimes works so strongly in the elementary conditions of mortals that much of their success in life is denied them until they are sent to advancing years. The action of this same law is responsible for holding apart soul mates upon the earth plane. While the law of repulsion is sometimes a great trouble to us in taking away from us what we most desire, yet without it the great law of attraction would be almost powerless, for the objects which are repulsed very often, and at last come into a vibration with the law of attraction, this law becomes, under such circumstances, very much stimulated, and taking up these adverse vibrations feeds upon them, and becomes mighty, and traveling with the velocity of lightning brings together the objects desired. The law of attraction is forever active, always feeding upon all other elementary laws, while the law of repulsion is oftentimes inactive, and very, very active when truly cross vibrations reach its center. In every atmospheric breeze that blows, there exists and travels the laws of repulsion and attraction. And in these laws exist vibration, and around and in vibration exists and moves wave motion. These vibratory wave motions only become individualized when taken up either by the law of attraction and repulsion, then they have a definite meaning, and they are success or failure to any or each individual they come in contact with after that. If there be, for instance, a man who lives in the farthest country of your globe, away from a woman who dwells equally as far away from him, and these two be the other half of each other, or in them dwells only the whole unit, then the law of attraction is never at rest until it vibrates each wave and finally joins their hands. There may be any amount of adverse conditions coming to them in their material environments, and so the wave motions may settle for a time with the law of repulsion, and so for a space upset all their plans, but if attraction can gain enough stimulus, then while these two mortals still live on the mortal plane, they will most assuredly meet and almost instantly unite, but if not completed on earth, attraction will eventually bring them together in spirit spheres. When soul mates meet and unite, the lost aspirations, aims and desires which each have given up as dead are again enlivened and awakened to full life, and they and each other become perfected in ideals, which could never have been dreamed of on any other condition or plane of existence. There are a great many people in your world who are seeking blindly for something that they scarcely hope to reach, and groping day by day in the darkness of lost hope, they merely make out to exist, and where to live. They do not even realize what the term means. Some great and beautiful, and as equally true an ideal has sometime in life faced them, and because they could not reach it they gave it up entirely. One great reason for this, and probably the principal reason in most cases, is because the other half of that soul is not to be found for so many years, and therefore it remains impossible for the one half to reach the full realization of his or her hopes, for where one is endowed with one or two essential qualities, the qualities existing in the other half of that soul is necessary in order to bring about the consummation of the whole soul's desire. For the qualities in the man and woman soul separately existing, when coming in contact with one another, would blend so perfectly that there would not be one chord out of vibrative harmony, not one element out of tune, so that this whole soul joined forever, could not possibly be unsuccessful in anything that it desired, for there would positively be no arbitrary forces there, and nothing but the fullness of overwhelming love and righteousness permeating all, filling the very essence of the air they breathe, whether in the physical or spiritual world. The law of soul mating is a permanent living law, always has been, is, and always will be, and because great numbers of earth and heaven yet are unaware of its existence, is never any proof that such a law is not. We of the higher spheres have attended many profound lectures on the subject of the philosophy of soul mating, and we are making a valiant effort to give our knowledge to the world of mortals as soon as they are able to receive it. Man's fear of death, Dr. Reed. Christianity professes to deliver you from the fear of death, and yet its teachers have steadily used this fear as a motive, and today large numbers remain in bondage to that dread. It is difficult to find one who does not fear and not regard death as the last great enemy, the darkest of all disasters, who does not speak of that which is common to you all as the inevitable calamity, but the spiritualist. Such dread is, perhaps, largely natural from early training. One hardly can be expected to contemplate without apprehension an event which puts such a period to your present experiences and which has issued concerning self and his surroundings. The trouble, or rather one trouble with your orthodox brethren, is, they know nothing about spiritual resurrection. You believe that what they are preaching is the resurrection of the body. Man preserves his identity and lives on in the spiritual world, building up the foundation he had laid in his early stage of being. It is evident that there is an awakening all over the land on the subject of spiritual truth as taught by the philosophy of spiritualism. He who says that spiritualism accepts, endorses, recognizes or tolerates the doctrine of free love, is mistaken. The worst man that ever lived does not deserve unending, hopeless suffering. Give everybody a chance either here or in the spirit world. Man is actuated by his ruling love, and his associates on earth are probably in sympathy with that love. Be guided in every action more by the inward voice than by any external direction, inasmuch as the internal is, and the external is not the true reality. A man may assume a virtue and thus deceive his friends, but on the spirit side nothing is covered that shall not be revealed, nor hid that shall not be known. The 15th, 16th and 17th centuries were remarkable for visions, and the 3rd, 4th and 5th for miracles. The visions were substantially the same as your mediums have, and the miracles correspond to the cures by magnetic healers in your day. The little I have seen of your world and know of the history of mankind teaches me to look upon their errors in sorrow, not in anger. When I look at one poor heart that has sinned and suffered, and represents to myself the struggles it passed through, the brief pulsations of joy, the tears of regret, the feebleness of purpose, the scorn of the world that has little charity, the desolation of the soul's sanctuary and threatening voices within, health gone, happiness gone, I would fain leave the erring soul of my fellow man with him from whose hand it came. Friends, let the standard of thought and action which mortals have erected be made subservient to the divine and immutable standard which is presented in nature and developed in soul. Spiritualists can understand, if their Christian brethren cannot, how Paul was caught up into the third heaven or sphere, and there beheld things unspeakable, without leaving the body. The character of a man's future for good or ill, whether happy or otherwise, is in a great measure dependent upon himself, at least upon him, as well as the material growth of a tree. A true, faithful spiritualist labors with disinterested feelings and motives for the good and happiness of others. It is an evidence of mental weakness to doubt the existence of the soul because your fingers cannot grasp it. We want salvation in the world. In the spirit world we will have it, because you take it with you. Once upon a time, a fond mother took her little 5-year-old daughter into the spare room and spent 3 whole hours in describing to her young mind the beauties of the Orthodox heaven, how they all would stand before a great white throne and wave palms and shout hymns to the Lord forever. Then turning to the sweet, innocent baby, she said, "You must always be good, then the Lord will let you stand before him and sing and wave palms, too." "I will, Mama," she said. "And if I am real good and wave lots of palms, don't you think the Lord will let me take my dolly some afternoon and go down to hell and play with the devil's little girls?" The child had a clearer and better conception of what constituted dwelling with God than her mother had. He who gives intellectual assent merely to the reality of spiritual intercourse and spirit manifestation has but a very slight conception of the universality of the law of spirit influence and control. An intellectual assent is but little more than a preliminary or introductory step towards an understanding of the true relations which a universal law has established between the spiritual and material worlds. These relations are most intimate, and the object and aim of their establishment were to allow the people of the two worlds to become cooperative, and this cooperation is beneficial to you in proportion to your worthiness to secure the benefit of intelligence higher than you are in moral and spiritual growth. It seems, however, that if one steps outside of the customary forms and practices, he is denounced as a crank, an eccentric, an unsafe guide. Originality is always at a discount. Every invention is first pronounced a failure. Every new thought has to force its way to recognition. Any change which affects the general trend of the people, either in thought or action, is met with stern resistance. Some ministers preach what they personally believe, and others preach what their audience believes. One leads his people, the other follows them. Some labor for hire, others to gratify ambition, still others are impelled onward in his work by neither of these considerations, but by an invisible impulse that they can neither stain or understand. The merchant, the time server, counts money, time, calculates chances, takes note of expenses in all the affairs of life, while the philanthropist, the philosopher, the scientist, the artist and the genius make no account of these questions, but simply work for the accomplishment of their purpose without regard to personal ends. You should regard your talents as a gift to all divine intelligence and hold them as a sacred trust. He should not only glorify his calling but be glorified and ennobled by it. The higher the ideals, the better the work. All of the great poets, philosophers and geniuses have seen visions or had some influences more or less from the spirit realms and felt their guidance. Some of the brightest and greatest men the world has produced have been called cranks. You must try to develop your individuality, then you will have more power to exert. Friends, did you ever stop to think that a great percent of talk of your world is valueless? It brings no revenue, it imparts no information. The closer you keep to nature, the nearer you are to spiritual understanding, for spiritualism is divine and a product of nature's laws. Spiritual spheres and conditions. Swedenborg. Friends, there are many spiritualists, yet not one in 50 among intelligent spiritualists of the present day, who knows what these doctrines are. The majority of people have heard something about them, and naturally suppose that what they heard is correct, but they will generally find, on careful inquiry, that what they have heard is very far from the truth. Many persons ridicule this doctrine, who know little or nothing of it beyond what they have learned from persons no better informed than themselves. The doctrine of spiritual spheres is unknown to many of the spiritualists, but many of them recognize its truth as soon as it is clearly stated, yet not until it is thoughtfully pondered, can you expect one to see how important it is in a practical point of view. You believe that there are particles too small for the eye to discern even by the aid of the most powerful microscope, constantly emanating from all material objects, and form around each a kind of atmosphere which in their essential nature, are similar to the object itself. This atmosphere is too refined and subtle to be detected by the senses, yet its existence round about thousands of objects, often manifests itself to the sense of smell, and in a dog. This sense is so acute that he can scent his master's sphere in the print of his shoes and distinguish his tracks from all others. The perfume of the lily or the rose is but the extension of the flower's own substance, the radiation or emanation of its own essence in the most subtle form. It is so of all other objects that diffuse an odor, grateful or otherwise. From the analogies of nature, therefore, it is reasonable to conclude that souls also have their encompassing spheres, and that these must be spiritual, and of the same quality in every case as the souls from whence they emanate.